From PowerlineBlog.com and produced by Ricochet.com, this is The Powerline Show with your host, Steve Hayward.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 306, the first of a two-part classic format conversation with Charles Murray and Steve Saylor. Now, the idea for this conversation actually began on Twitter when someone posted an item asking if Murray and Saylor, who have never met, I think, would be willing to do a podcast together. I offered the Powerline Show as a venue, and they both agreed. And then there followed on Twitter, at our invitation, a lot of discussion about what questions they'd like Charles and Steve to take up, and it was an active Twitter thread, so there's been considerable interest, which shows that not everything on Twitter is horrible. And we'll come to some of those questions here in due course. Now, to say that Charles Murray and Steve Saylor are controversial is as commonplace as saying the sky is blue. But I think what that really indicates is the narrowness of the conventional wisdom, and much worse, the refusal of what we call conventional wisdom, for lack of a better term, to consider politically inconvenient or uncomfortable facts candidly. And hence what we get instead is a censoriousness unworthy of a liberal society and counterproductive to the very people and causes that liberals say that they champion. Now, Charles Murray is the Brady Scholar Emeritus at the American Enterprise Institute, where we were colleagues for the 10 years that I was a fellow there. He's a well-known social scientist who first burst on the scene with Losing Ground in 1984 about the failures of American social policy. And then a decade later, it became even more controversial with the publication of The Bell Curve, which most of its critics, I'm convinced, never bothered to read, or if they did read it, they misread it, or they grossly distort its argument. Whether deliberately or out of malice or political cowardice, I leave to you to decide. Now, longtime listeners of The Powerline Show may recall a long conversation I had with Charles, turns out 4 years ago now, time flies, where I walked him through the whole arc of his life and career, from his days as a student at Harvard, time in the Peace Corps, and then, of course, the evolution of his thought as he came to middle age, you might say. We also did take a nice digression in that episode, which I've linked in the show notes, to a wonderful narrative account he wrote of the Apollo space program, which he co-authored with his wife, Catherine Cox. His most recent book, and one germane to today's conversation, is Facing Reality: Two Truths About Race in America. Steve Saylor is a journalist known for his utter fearlessness in reporting on stories and facts that most journalists simply avoid, especially on race and immigration. But you shouldn't overlook his fine cultural criticism, such as his, I think, sparkling movie reviews, observations about art, even golf courses. Now, for his heterodoxy, he is, of course, labeled a white nationalist and much worse by some of the usual egregious suspects like the Southern Poverty Law Center. But if you read his articles, you come to see immediately why his critics resort to ad hominem attacks. He always backs up his arguments with facts and statistics, and he presents his arguments with steel trap logic. I think his critics understand and won't debate him because they know they will likely lose. Our conversation today comes in two parts. We decided to take our time and really work through a lot of the questions. And so in this first hour, we look at the general scene of race and politics in America today. And in the second half of the conversation, which will be released next week in a separate episode, we look more closely at some specifics of education in America today. In particular, how to think about the current attack on meritocracy, the decision to get rid of a lot of tests like the SAT for college admissions, and along with some ideas for reforming college admissions and improving education. And at the very end, we return to the beginning with some observations on reasons to be optimistic and pessimistic about America's future and what both Steve and Charles think may be ahead for us and what they think might need to happen. So without further ado, let's bring on Steve and Charles and get started. Well, Charles and Steve, thanks for sitting down and doing this. And gosh, there's been such a lot of interest on Twitter. What I want to do, I think, is try to do this in two parts. First, talk about the general scene a bit, and then move on to some of the more specific questions that I know you guys have worked on and that people on Twitter have suggested. And I don't know, maybe this is too broad a question, but I've been saying for a while now that it wouldn't surprise me if future historians don't write about this period with new designations of BGF and AGF, which would stand for Before George Floyd and After George Floyd. And, Charles is a certified old guy. Steve, you and I are getting close to that. But could you, either of you, have imagined that the reaction and the aftermath to the George Floyd incident would have been as extreme and reckless and nonsensical as it has been, or that exceed even your low expectations for things? Who wants to go first, Charles?
If anybody was in a position to say, oh, yeah, this is going to be awful, it's me, because the Middlebury thing occurred before the George Floyd thing. And the Middlebury thing resulted in a concussion for the faculty member who was, you know, moderating my presentation. But I'm just unable to process each day's news. You know, the American Mathematical Association is doing something about DIE, or is it DEI? I can never get it straight. I'm saying to myself, why does the Mathematical Association have to? No, I'm completely flummoxed by this whole thing.
Yeah. Steve?
I think there's some logic to it. Basically, ideas have consequences. And, you know, a couple of things have been going on. One is, what's changed since the bell curve? I constantly read that the bell curve of 1994 is discredited, but I look around and the world sure looks like the one that's explained by Charles and the late Richard J. Herrnstein. And and since about 2013, since about Obama's reelection, during the first term, Obama clearly was keeping kind of a lid on where Democrats wanted to go until he got reelected. But after that, it was kind of the momentum built up, what a commentator named Spotted Toad calls the Great Awakening. And scholars like David Rosato and Zach Goldberg of Georgia State have documented a real takeoff about 2013 that was well underway toward wokeness long before Trump came down the escalator in June 2015. So, you know, So ideas have consequences. There's a fundamental logic to the way the Overton window works. Mm. You know, when Charles was a controversial but still tolerated voice in the mainstream media representing the realist right, there was plenty of room for centrists. But, you know, as we've seen, Charles's book, Facing Reality, largely was ignored, wasn't reviewed in the New York Times last year. And so the former centrists are now the extreme right-wingers, and the only respectable voice left to explain the great issues of our time involving race, which are the great issues, is Ibram X. Kendi.
Mm. Well, you know, that was one of my questions, is who's the worst left-wing thinker in the country today, and why is his name Ibram Kendi? But we can come back to that maybe. Actually, can I throw back to Charles here for a second on the bell curve? And bring us up to date in this way. I mean, I remember when it came out, I hadn't actually met you at that point, Charles, or maybe once briefly, but I remember the fuss about it. I remember you got death threats. I remember seeing an NBC News segment where you had asked them not to broadcast where you lived out there in rural Maryland, understandably so. You know, it did get treated seriously in the New Republic, right? They ran an excerpt and responses.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, life went on, and then it all blew up again about the same time Steve points out when the Great Awakening starts. Suddenly, the bell curve became current again. So, two-part question. One is, I don't remember this. I know there were serious responses, but nowadays it's clear to me that people who take off on the bell curve haven't bothered to read a single word of it. But going back, were there serious responses to it that you think were, you know, worthy of your attention? Did you expect it to be quite the sensation that it was? And then third part, I said two part, three parts. What explains why it erupted again? Or maybe it's as simple as Steve's idea.
Well, I don't want to spend too much time on it because Steve and I have so many things to talk about right. What's going on now. Real quickly, people didn't read the bell curve even when it first came out.
Right.
the number of and a lot of the response you asked were the responses I respected, and of course the politic thing for me to say is to be very serious. Yes, there were. Well, it's really hard for me to think of any that impressed me, and there were some that were written by very famous scholars that I just thought were pure horse manure.
Yeah,
and others of which I thought they were knowingly lying. That these people were too smart and too well informed not to know that they were lying about what was in the book. I think the really interesting thing about the 2013 reawakening is I would like to be able to place that in the trajectory of our first Black president. And I think Steve probably has thought about this more deeply than I have. But I've had this thought that if you go back to 2008, in a lot of ways, things were pretty good in terms of race relations, not only in the Gallup poll stuff, but think about what was going on. You had highly respected Black figures on the national media and not affirmative action babies at all, but really good journalists. Black journalists in print, Black journalists in the screen. You had actors in big roles in movies that weren't. Everybody accepted the legitimacy of these Black stars as being serious, important figures, and in all sorts of areas of life. In retrospect, it looks like things were getting better and better. And then we elect a Black president in the first 4 years, as Steve says. He was a disappointment in many ways. But then why in 2013 the eruption? Well, let me just throw out a thought I've had. That's not full explanation, but it may play into it. And that is, in many ways, by 2013, Blacks were becoming much more marginalized as an important component of American life than they had been previously. Which is to say, first, they're only 13% of the population, 12-13%. So that's not big, never was big. But it used to be that they had important niches in the economy. And they sort of lost those. And then you had, at the same time, Hispanics moving into a lot of those. So the construction industry, certainly in Texas, which is the only place in the Southwest I know well, but Steve knows the Southwest and Southern California, the construction industry in Texas would go belly up if it weren't for Latino workers. And I don't mean just general labor. I mean highly skilled labor. And Latinos were getting in, and also in the hospitality business and others, Latinos were really becoming a much more important minority in all sorts of ways, economically and numerically, than Blacks. And I was saying to myself, this is one of the, sorry to go on with this, but real quickly, I was saying to myself at that time, you know what? Blacks are just going to fade away as being much of an issue because they aren't economically that important. And there are much smaller numbers than the Latinos. And boy, was I wrong. So what caused that? Why all at once this incredible upwelling of energy?
Yeah, the Democrats have a grand strategy of putting together a coalition of the margins of American society and using the increasing diversification of American society to get to a one-party status. But the problem with assembling a coalition of Blacks, transgenders, tech billionaires, Jews, gays, feminists, et cetera, is that it can turn into a circular firing squad. Who's in charge? And the way the Democrats have handled that is like, well, let's ignore our internal rivalries and focus on the bad guys who are white. And then the feminists go, oh, what about, oh, well, women aren't bad guys. Okay, we mean white men. And then the gays say, oh, yeah, but we mean straight white men. And then it's the cisgendered straight white men, et cetera. So it's a smaller and smaller group of who is to be defamed and denounced and blamed for everything. But it's hard to keep African Americans playing nice with everybody else. They kind of want to be number one. And they played very nice up through the first Obama term. But then things got unleashed after that. And you can kind of see it from like two kinds of statistics that I follow and I've just updated for 2021. Murders and traffic fatalities. And you can see the upsurge beginning at Ferguson in August 2014 and spreading locally. But yeah, all of a sudden, not just people getting murdered more, but people getting killed in traffic accidents. Why? Because the cops were pulling back. Then the Trump administration came in and both numbers kind of trickled a little bit down. And then along comes the racial reckoning. And so I've just added up the numbers for the last 7 months of... Okay, so for 2021, I checked a big city... homicides, they were up 45% over 2019. That's just a huge, unprecedented change. Maybe even crazier was that car deaths, pedestrian deaths, anything involving traffic, went up 20% per mile driven from 2019 to 2021. Nobody saw that coming.
And can I interrupt just a second there, Steve? Do we know where that's happening? And the reason I ask that is maybe you saw the ProPublica story last week that the traffic cameras in Chicago are racist because they're giving too many radar, photo traffic tickets to minorities.
Yeah, I was able to find year-end 2021 counts in early January from 30 states. It's pretty random which 30 are just ones where the bureaucrats do a good job of adding up traffic fatalities without too long a lag at the end of the year. And it was huge. It's 17% higher than in 2019 in raw terms from those 30 states. And the number of miles has gone down 3%. So some of it is due to to COVID allowing people to drive like a bat out of hell, but a lot has to do with the racial reckoning that began on May 25th, 2020, when society decided that basically, you know, every cop is a criminal and all the sinners saints. And now we're paying the price in murders and in car crashes, the latter nobody saw coming.
I still, though, would like to drill down a little more into what the hell happened around 2013. Because if you talk to Jonathan Haidt, I think it was Haidt who I got this from, he says that the whole atmosphere on college campuses changed dramatically at about that time. And Steve, I think you were on campuses at that time.
Yeah.
And that it seemed like a generational shift in the nature of the undergraduate student bodies. And I'm wondering to what extent that plays into it. I'm wondering to what extent there is a relationship between the racial reckoning and that generational change in the students. And I guess the final thing that I want to, and I'm putting up things that I don't have answers to, it's almost as if in around 2013, 14, 15, black intellectuals of the left said, yeah, these things are never going to go away, these differentials, whether it's in test scores or in employment, occupational distributions. No movement has occurred, or very little movement has occurred. And they looked at all that and they were forced into saying, oh, gee, maybe we have some underlying reasons for this, which we are powerless to affect, or saying it's somebody's fault. And that you had the years of a dramatic effort in the early 2000s with No Child Left Behind to close the academic educational gap, millions of, not just billions of dollars spent, but disruption of the school systems. As someone who had children in school at that time, an incredible disruption. You saw a variety of other ways, aggressive affirmative action continued throughout those years, and it didn't change a damn thing.
Yeah.
And so something catalyzed everything to boil up and boil over.
Yeah, the first Obama term was kind of the high point for billionaires pushing educational reform of various kinds, and nothing much happened. So, yeah, there's, you know, I mean, the centrist view that, yeah, things will get better steadily for blacks, that kind of lost out because not much is changing. I mean, you know, I just noticed that 21% of African Americans are now of immigrant stock. 12% are immigrants, and another 9% are children of immigrants. And they black immigrants, especially from Africa, tend to do a little better. I mean, and so in some ways, when we're just looking at the black statistics overall, they look a little better than they are because they're being pumped up by educated blacks from Nigeria and the like, suggesting, yeah, the American descendants, you know, descendants of American slaves are not doing terribly well, even worse than the generally flat line suggest. So that kind of leads to questions like, okay, we either need to bear down and really try harder to reform our culture, or it's not, or we can blame white people and try to get more money from them. And that the latter seems like has been a pretty successful operation so far, especially getting money if you're in the, you know, the activist class. Getting money from billionaires has just been a gold mine over the last 2 years.
Yeah. Well, now, I do think, as you were speaking earlier about, in particular, Zach Goldberg, I've talked to him. You know, he's a, you know, PhD student at Georgia State, whose academic advisors told him not to make this the focus of his dissertation work. And he's doing it anyway. And he's producing some really robust and fascinating quantitative results. I do think we need a historian, social analyst, someone like Charles, to give us a, you know, a wider gauge theory of why this happened. And Charles, you, I remember a conversation with you 4 or 5 years ago when this was bubbling up and catching us by surprise. And one idea you tossed out then, and I want you to revisit it right now, is that you thought part of this was a disappointment and adverse reaction to the failures of Obama. Obama hadn't delivered us to the promised land, and they don't want to blame him directly, but instead this is a result of frustration, something like that. Does that sound familiar?
Well, if you go back and say that when Obama was elected, there was a lot of elation throughout the country. Including in the Murray household. I did not vote for Obama. My wife did. But I, too, I joined in the general feeling that, you know, maybe we'll be able to put an awful lot of this stuff behind us. We've elected a president of the United States who's black. Doesn't that really indicate that that we can just all relax now and go back to treating each other as individuals instead of worrying about the race stuff so much? And that optimism was extremely widespread. Obama was a disappointment. He was certainly a disappointment to people on the center right who were willing to cut him some slack because he didn't govern the way that he campaigned. He was also a disappointment to the people on the left because he really didn't deliver much of anything. And if you have that kind of disappointment, and it's over a period of 4 years. It's the end of the first term. He's gotten elected to the second term. Things still aren't changing. You're just putting together a picture at this point of we got to find we got to find a reason for all of this not improving, and white supremacy politics and all that was an obvious target. I'm really speculating here. Yep. I'm not presenting this as any kind of thing I'm prepared to defend.
It makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I've seen over the course of my lifetime is that kind of American intellectual discourse has gotten more childish, and it's turning into kind of a boyish good guys versus bad guys. You identify who the good guys are, and they're good, so they deserve to win, and therefore the bad guys must be cheating to be keeping them from winning. And yeah, that's, you know, that didn't seem like a dominant thought during the early Obama years, but it came back with a vengeance right after his reelection. And, you know, it's a very popular way to think, and it looks like you can get a lot of money that way if you're good at calling people bad guys.
Well, let me follow up with you, Steve, and press this along a little further in this way. As you mentioned a few minutes ago, ideas have consequences. A lot of the ideas informing the new racial radicalism, for lack of a better term, wokeness, they've been on the shelf for a long time. They go back decades in many cases. And like Charles, who mentions in Facing Reality, I always thought it was going to be mostly confined to college campuses and the New York Times editorial board. And what we've seen now is it's broken out, as you said, everywhere, to corporate America. You know, J.P. Morgan has pledged billions of dollars for Black Lives Matter and so forth. And museums, every cultural institution you can point to. And as you say, it didn't start with George Floyd. It was barreling along before that. And so the question is how do we account for the breakout? I'm asking the same question I'm asking Charles, and I don't think we've really got our hands around this yet.
Right. I mean, if you go back to 1990, the Duke English department was heavily into French theory of a deconstructionist mode and was clearly a proto-woke institution. But then it sort of faded, especially with feminism being embarrassing itself in the Clinton scandals, defending Bill Clinton against charges of sexual harassment just after feminism had made a big comeback in 1991 with the sexual harassment controversy over Anita Hill. So you had a period in which kind of wokeness kind of dropped out of the headlines. Political correctness was not as powerful as an issue on, say, the New York Times's op-ed page. But it was still working away in the institutions and, you know, generating cadres of not hugely bright people. 1990, it was kind of Stanley Fish standing up for political correctness. Well, Stanley Fish is a bright guy. He's Morris Zapp and David Lodge's comic novels about English professors. By the 2000s, you're getting a whole bunch of cadres of people who benefit from affirmative action, and they really need the affirmative action if their careers are going to go anywhere. But there's a lot of them, and they have a lot of students, and they can give extra credit for going to the demonstration and things like that. So that's one possibility there. It's just a mass of kind of people who are pretty marginal intellectually.
Yeah, you know,
got some power and budgets.
Yeah, now I have picked up on, although I don't want to take this up, but I'll just say in passing an observation that I think what's my observation on college campuses is a lot of these special studies areas, gender studies, critical theory, et cetera, that are the hotbeds of a lot of this. Most of the even mainstream liberal academics I know, and I know quite a few now, they regard that as second rate, third rate, frivolous stuff. They ignore it as the best they can. And I think the people in those disciplines know that. And it fuels their rage and makes their rage even greater. But the administrators cave in. The new thing, which you may be following, is the cluster hires. Departments are hiring. We want to hire 5 or 6 people committed to social justice. And of course, a cluster hire lends itself to an obvious epithet, which we'll pass over for now. Let me do this. Yeah. Go back. So go ahead. Here, you want to follow that?
So you have a bunch of people who aren't really competent much, except for arguing that their budget should be expanded so they can hire more cadres to work for them and argue for more. It's a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
We've also got a huge growth in the administrative support staffs.
Yeah.
I mean, just huge.
You don't have to know anything to do that.
Yeah, I was going to come to reform ideas later, but I'll mention one right now on this particular point. I think that for public universities in red states, that's the only place this might happen, the legislature should pass a law that the diversity, equity, and inclusion staff can be no larger than the tenured faculty of the history department, step one. And step two, administrator in the DEI bureaucracy can be paid more than a tenured professor in the history department. And then see what happens.
Yes.
Actually, half serious about that. But
the only better public policy idea I can remember hearing is to make air conditioning illegal in the District of Columbia.
Yes, right.
The theory being that this
take the summer off.
Right, Charles. Let me throw
Coolidge era Washington D.C.
All right, Charles. Let me throw back to you for a moment because you know we're all familiar with each other's work. But I think for listeners who haven't read Facing Reality or other books, I wonder. Since Facing Reality is a good short book with two main points, I wonder if you'd briefly summarize your two main points about Facing Reality for us.
Sure. And I'll just give a sentence as to why I wrote the book in the first place, which is after the George Floyd riots and so forth. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing, that nobody was saying, well, you know, one of the reasons that Blacks have bad interactions with police is because their crime rate is just way higher. And so the reason that Microsoft doesn't have very many upper-level technical people who are Black is because of differences in cognitive ability that mean that in the pipeline there just aren't enough people who can do those jobs. And that if you're going to talk about systemic racism, you can't do that unless you acknowledge those two realities. And so in the book, I say, look, I'm not going to talk about causes, not going to worry about nurture versus nature, not going to say things are never going to change. I'm just saying that what's on the ground right now is just simply a statement of fact that you can't argue with. And one is that when you have tests of cognitive ability or any other kind of academic achievement, and you give them to Asians and Latinos and whites and Blacks, you get different means. And they are importantly different. And this has consequences. It has consequences for job performance. It has consequences for academic performance and promotions and all sorts of things. And the second one is that the rates of violent crime among Blacks are multiples of what they are among whites. And actually, the original contribution of the book was I got the arrest records from 13 cities, including some of the biggest cities in the country, which were online, downloadable. And some of them, by the way, have been taken offline since I got them downloaded. And this is pre-George Floyd. My crime data come from the early 2000s to about 2019. That's before this big increase in homicides that Steve was talking about. Over the 13 cities that I was able to get data for, the rate of arrest for violent crime for Blacks was a median of 9 times the white rate. And in New York and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., it was higher than that. And this is not, I go through all the reasons that you can't ascribe this to bias in who gets arrested. Among other things, when people report being victimized, Blacks and Latinos report Black perpetrators more often than whites do. So anyway, you have these huge differences. You have to face up to them no matter whether you're on the left or the right, because you can't talk about systemic racism independently of taking these two realities into account. And I was just telling... you earlier, I think, offline, that my family was very unhappy that I was going to write this book, that it was going to destroy my legacy and so forth. And none of us predicted that it would sink without a trace, and nobody would pay the slightest bit of attention to it.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is about the radio silence over the book, including among the conservative press. I mean, the Wall Street Journal didn't review it. I don't think National Review did. And is that, I mean, my
National
my first,
Review or Commentary, I think, did had a review.
But okay. My first pass at a field theory without having thought about it is, the book came out at a time when even many conservatives were in a defensive crouch over the shocking turn the country had taken and were just afraid to take it up. I don't know.
Well, a larger point is, Steve, that conservatives have always been unhappy about talking about race differences.
Yeah.
You did not have conservatives cheering the bell curve when it came out. For one thing, it makes people intensely uncomfortable to raise these issues. And I understand why it makes them intensely uncomfortable. And they would just rather it go under the rug. And of course, libertarians want to believe that everybody can be a big success if only they put their minds to it and have the freedom to act. And I have described myself in print as a libertarian for many years. And one of the things that I object to among libertarians is they are completely unwilling to accept the limitations that people have that are beyond their control, including things involving intellect. So, yeah, this has never been something where you had one side of the political spectrum cheering on people who were doing work in race differences and the other side of the political spectrum attacking it. It's always been a problem for people on the right to accept the existence of race differences in behavior and cognitive ability and other things.
I think in some ways, I think you can trace back this bad circumstance at least to the Moynihan Report in 1965. Remember the reaction that Moynihan got for that when, like the bell curve, if you read it, it couldn't have been more sympathetic to the interests and causes of advancing blacks in America. Mm-hmm. But he was made a non-person, and okay, we know that story. Steve, I want to ask you, I know Charles' whole story of how he got drawn into all these issues, starting with his practical experience, really going back to the Peace Corps in the 60s. How did you get started in thinking about and writing about some of these issues that get everybody into trouble who takes them up in a serious way?
It goes back to 1972 when I was 13 and starting high school debate, and the topic involved funding of education. So I started researching and reading Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the Coleman Report, Christopher Jenks's meta-analysis of all the data brought up for the Coleman Report, and so forth. James Q. Wilson's work, all sorts of, the interesting social scientists of about 50 years ago. And basically, I found it really interesting in much the same way I find baseball statistics interesting. And kind of over time in the 80s, I got familiar with Bill James, the baseball statistics writer, and went like, oh, well, we could do something like that for bigger issues, more important stuff. And, kind of my role model was a columnist for Fortune named Daniel Seligman, who was kind of the first blogger and did kind of quantitative analysis of social issues in kind of an informal way. And yeah, that's kind of where I've come out ever since, as sort of a data social science oriented opinion journalist. Not really that ambitious to write big books, and carve out whole new areas like Charles. But, I like numbers, and, they're very important for these issues.
The most eclectic body of knowledge anybody I know.
You will write
about golf course design and about a whole melange of cultural, social issues, and I have no idea where you come up with these numbers, but they're fascinating.
You know, yeah, I think somebody
says I have leaky neurons, and so ideas kind of cross-fertilize each other from somewhere.
Well, I think, Charles, there may be something about guys named Steve, because I started high school the same year as Steve, the same age. I was also doing high school debate, and I remember that debate topic quite well. It was could there be federal aid to education? And, you know, you're supposed to argue and debate both sides, but I much preferred the negative that year, I remember. Oh, so that's really funny.
Right, there's the hidden history of realist thought in the 21st century,
yeah.
1972 debate proposition.
Right. All right. So I want to ask the same question to each of you in a different form. One is Charles, in your introduction to Facing Reality, you talk about how, I'll just quote you here. You say these facts, two main facts, have been distorted or exploited for malign purposes by racist and hateful people. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that and how you think they, give us some examples perhaps of how they are misused and how we should respond to misuses. And then I have a different form of the same question for you, Steve.
Okay, it's very simple. There are white supremacist groups in this country. and given the information on differences in black and white IQ and so forth, they run with that and put it in terms of superiority and inferiority and generalize this in ways which I'm not going to name specific names, because you have a sequence of people going from those who I take seriously but profoundly disagree with to those who I just find to be kind of evil. Not kind of evil, evil. And when I say they misuse it, one of the great problems I have that extends across almost all readers, including those who hate the bell curve, is people cannot grasp the difference between differences in means and differences in distributions. And so they want to run with the idea, oh, if you have a difference in means, that means this group is good and that group's bad. And they don't want to talk about the overlapping distributions, which mean, in the case of IQ, that millions of blacks are smarter than millions of whites. And by failing to recognize or simply ignoring the role of distributions, focusing on the mean differences, and using the language of superiority and inferiority, I think that's not just a misuse; it's a profoundly destructive misuse.
Yeah, well, let you use this opportunity to go directly on the record, as I think I've heard you say before. Differences between groups, even taking into account the overlap that's important that you just mentioned, has no bearing on the equality of human beings.
Yes, and okay, this is one of the things that irritates me the most about people who are my allies. And now I'm not talking about the white supremacists anymore. I'm talking about people who I am amazed that they find it so hard to accept that IQ is not a measure of human worth, you know? So just this week on Twitter, somebody said, it seems to me that you're saying two things. You're saying that because of group differences in behavior, that you can have priors about expectations of behavior, which can lead you to rationally behave in racist ways. Which is true insofar as if you deprive me of any information about a person except his or her race, and I'm choosing a physician, and I know the statistics on the MCAT scores of blacks and whites in medical schools and Asians in medical schools. If you forbid me from having any of the other information about them, then I will rationally choose the Asian physician first, and then I'll choose the white physician second and the black physician third. But that's a terrible situation to be put in, because what I want is to be able to treat those people as an individual. And so what I find it difficult for me to understand is how someone cannot understand that you can have a difference in means between two groups, and you still have a profound moral obligation as an individual to do the very best you can to treat the people you encounter as individuals. That's one thing that I can't understand. And the other one is equating someone being smarter with another person with that person being better than the other person. And here I try to imagine a Judeo-Christian God worthy of the name, who looks down upon us human beings and says, oh, Steve is better than Julia because Steve has an IQ 15 points higher. I mean, that is just so incomprehensible to me.
I wonder if that problem might be related in many instances on the ferocity about this on the left, maybe wrapped up in the progressive presumption of their philosophy of elitist government, right? Smart people should be in charge because yeah. We're better than they are, right? I mean, this we can see this in the COVID debate and so forth. All right. Steve, let me give you a version of that question, unless you want to answer the exact same one, which is this also comes from some of the people who commented on Twitter. I'll give you both sides of the question. What irritates you most about your adversaries? What irritates you the most about your allies? The question I asked Charles.
I try not to get that irritated. I mean, I'm somewhat irritating in that because I'm rather unambitious and not very ideological or egotistical, that when I present data that say, oh, America has a problem with car crashes that seems to be tied to the racial reckoning, that in the last 7 months of 2020, following George Floyd's death on May 25th, 2020, Blacks were killed in car crashes 36% more often than in the same months in 2019. And they died in homicides across the country 53% more than in the same months in 2019. And that seems bad because I'm against, my ideology is I'm against murder and I'm against traffic fatalities. And the usual response I get to that tends to be, why do you know that? What's your deep, dark secret that makes you know things like that? And I don't, my secret is, it seems important. I don't like people dying violently. And I sort of believe like the college motto in Animal House that knowledge is good, but a lot of people don't really think that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. Now a question for both of you, that I think I also saw on Twitter that I thought that occurred to me also. What writers and thinkers on the center left do you admire or find worthwhile to engage, even if you don't necessarily admire their thought or character? Who wants to go first?
Well, maybe I'll jump in front of Charles, but, the late philosopher James Flynn, who discovered a huge phenomenon in IQ studies that had escaped people and that Charles named the Flynn effect, a man of the left, he wrote to Arthur Jensen in the 1970s and said, I've been looking at a bunch of studies and it looks like raw IQ test scores keep going up all around the world decade after decade, and the publishers of IQ tests have to keep making it harder to get a 100 score. And Jensen, the great Berkeley psychologist and expert on IQ, said, Here's four challenges to that make that seem that I suspect would be true and would kind of undermine the importance of your finding. And then for over about 10 years of back and forth, eventually Jensen went, yeah, I guess you've met most of my challenges here. You know, this is the kind of thing that should be taught in philosophy of science, as this is what good scientists do. I don't know why raw IQ scores have gone up so much. I don't know if they're still going up, but it does induce humility in people who, it should induce humility in people like me who think I kind of have this IQ thing figured out, but I don't really know what the answer to that question is.
Yeah, no, I've noticed that, you know, a couple of columns you have referenced seemingly favorably, or at least not disfavorably, like, Thomas Bernhard Saul at the New York Times, writes for the New York Times. And he's a wonderfully nice man, by the way. I've met him once and talked to him at some length and was surprised at how much I liked him personally. And, you know, he's pretty honest about looking at the social science data and keeping an open mind, I'll put it that way, even though he's a person of liberal commitments. Yeah. Matt Iglesias seems to be breaking from the liberal reservation ways.
Yeah. I mean, he's a real smart guy and says interesting things.
Yeah, I've met him too. He's not as pleasant as Edsall. But Charles, I know you've mentioned Michael Sandel a lot lately. Yeah. And start with him or whoever you like.
Well, I'll start with Tom Edsall, who there is only one journalist who, when he gets in touch with me and asks me questions about IQ or race, the rest of it, that I answer without any fear that my words are going to be distorted. And that's Tom Edsall. I have absolute confidence that he will treat whatever I gave him appropriately in a good professional journalistic way. There are some people, thinkers on the left that I think have wonderful insights. Michael Walzer, I think he was at Princeton, and he wrote a book called Spheres of Justice that was I thought, a big improvement on John Rawls' theory of justice. And among other things, I quoted his analysis of the difference between self-esteem and self-respect very approvingly in Pursuit, one of the books I think the most of in my own work. And more recently, Michael Sandel, who has a book called The Tyranny of Merit, where he raises all sorts of the same kinds of things that were worrying me in Coming Apart about the elites and the increasing contempt that the elites have for ordinary Americans, and the ways in which the elites have fallen down on the job in terms of their role in society. And Sandel is a man of the left, and I found myself, as I read The Tyranny of Merit, just nodding my head in agreement over and over again. And of course, Christopher Lash, back in the 1980s, I guess it was, 90s, wrote some things that were quite prescient about the problems with what was happening with the classes in America. And if you get down to it, Daniel Bell, The Coming of Post-Industrial Society is just about as prescient as social science gets. So there are lots of people on the left whose work I have found very useful, insights that are very important. However, all the people I just named, except for Sandel, are either dead or are past the main parts of their careers. And it's kind of hard to see. Well, Jonathan Haidt, I'm not even sure he considers himself a man of the left anymore, but he was a man who confronted the data and ran with it. And this is something I wish we'd talk more about, this kind of thing. The people on the other side of the ideological divide who we admire and respect. And I frankly wish more people on the left would talk about people on the right and say ways in which it would be nice if some of the people on the left would acknowledge that, gee, they thought some things in the bell curve actually were important and they've incorporated it into their own work, but now they call it educated class as opposed to the cognitive elite. Okay, all I ask is let's have a little reciprocal saying, you know what, we each learn from the other, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Is there this question for both of you? Is there any particular person or persons that you'd most like to debate?
Oh, most like to debate. Oh, yeah, the person I wish that I would have a chance to debate. And I almost suggested that we have invite him to come on with us today, is John McWhorter.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think John McWhorter is just one of the more interesting intellectuals out there. Among other things, he's a brilliant linguist, which has created a number of rifts within the Murray family, because John has a, I can call him by my first name because we are acquainted, friendly acquaintances, because John has a much more permissive attitude than I have toward dynamic language that can take on new meanings. And so my daughter is on his side on a couple of very important disputes, such as the misuse of disinterest. But John, to get back to the main point, is a really interesting guy. And so I'd love to engage in the kind of conversation we're having, but I wouldn't want to call it a debate.
Yeah.
I also was in debate in high school. I suspicion myself, I was rather successful. I've never liked debate since then. I got so fed up with having to pretend that I had this set of absolutely certain convictions that I truly thought weren't nearly that simple. So I don't have debates if I can avoid them. I like conversations.
So same question, Steve. By the way, I think that sometimes debates or arguments with people who agree with you on some things are more interesting and useful than debates with someone who's your complete opposite. So call it a debate or not, an old-fashioned dialectical engagement, I think, is what we're missing. Steve, same question. Do you have either a critic, semi-friend that you would most like to debate?
No, probably not. I'm a more obscure character. I don't know who should I debate. Well, how about Professor Kendi?
He won't debate
in some
anybody,
ways. But, our brains sort of work alike in terms of having a tendency toward reductionist language that tries to boil our thoughts down to the simplest and perhaps most aggravating fashion. So that might be interesting, but I don't think that's going to happen.
All right. I want to ask one last political question for our first half of this dialogue. I think both of you know that, you know, Amy Wax at Penn is in a whole lot of hot water right now for saying on Glenn Lowry's podcast that we ought to have lower rates of Asian immigration. And she made it political. It's just because they support the Democratic Party and that's bad. Okay. I wonder what either of you, especially you, Steve, out here in California with me, what do you make of the movement of quite a number of Asians and Hispanic voters towards the Republicans in the last couple of election cycles? Is it significant? Do you think it'll continue? Does it suggest that, as you were saying earlier, this rainbow coalition that the left has been relying on is so unstable that it can't possibly work? And therefore, is there a reason to be optimistic?
All right. So in 2020, the Democratic establishment, leading figures like Elizabeth Warren and so forth, the New York Times decided a couple of things about linguistics. One was that from now on, blacks were going to be always capitalized. It's called reverential capitalization in biblical translations. And in fact, they weren't even going to be blacks anymore. They had to be black people. And you can get, probably in about 3 months, you can get canceled for saying blacks rather than blacks with a capital, black with a capital B, people. The establishment decided that Latinos and Latinas were now Latinx, even though that's pretty much unpronounceable in Spanish. That is purely symbolic, but it is representative of where in the post-George Floyd era, who's on top of the totem pole of diversity. And it's not Latinx. They're kind of spear holders at the bottom, even though the grand strategy of how the Democrats are going to win is kind of like really dependent on Hispanics.
Yeah. Charles, do you have a thought on this? I know you don't follow the ins and outs of electoral politics with the same degree of attention to, say, Michael Barone, but I wonder if you
I'm following this one, and I think the swing of the of Latinos toward away from the liberalism or the progressivism, I think that is going to accelerate. I think we've just seen the beginning. I think that if we get candidates running for the Republicans who are more like Youngkin, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, than Trump, that we'll see that accelerate. As for Asians, I know what the history has been of their voting. When you have educational policies which are saying their kids cannot get into magnet schools because the progressives have decided you need to have more people of color, and Asians really aren't people of color in any important sense of that term in their ideology. When you're taking educational opportunities away from their kids, the way that is happening right now, they are not going to vote for those people. And in all sorts of other ways, I think that it is unnatural that Asians have been voting so heavily for Democrats. I don't think it's going to continue. And here's the issue that nobody has talked about. I'm trying to think of any articles I've seen on it. And that is the antagonisms between Blacks and Hispanics and Latinos. These are not natural allies. And the tensions between the two of them have been exacerbated, I think, partly because of what Steve just said about they're the spear carriers and they are supposed to play their role without getting too big for their britches in terms of current politics. But yeah, also just Latinos still have a very different culture from a lot of Black culture. Now, I hesitated that you have a Black middle class that is still very conservative culturally. But overall, the family is much stronger in Latino neighborhoods. Religion is much stronger. And there are all sorts of ways in which I think that they've been looking for, Latinos have been looking for kind of a catalyst to get out from thrall of the Democrats.
Yeah, but one other thing with Latinos is that their crime rate has dropped considerably since the 1990s relative to both whites and Blacks. That at the present time, or at least until the racial reckoning got started, I'm not so sure about since 2020. The Latino homicide rate has dropped considerably and is not that far above the white rate, maybe double or something, or maybe higher than that. But it's come down quite a bit since the crack war years, and that's not well recognized.
Well,
that's an important development. I don't even know why it's happened. It doesn't appear to have been studied much yet, but somebody should look into it.
One of the things that was really interesting, Steve, in the 13 cities that I had arrest data for, is that, yeah, there were important differences in Latino crime and white crime in the biggest cities. But you got down to the smaller cities in my sample, and in a couple of cases, the rates were virtually the same for whites and Latinos. And in one case, I think they were lower. And these were all smaller cities. And I speculate, I don't have any more data to test this out. I speculate that importantly different elevated crime rates in Latinos is pretty much restricted to the megalopolises.
Yeah, it's perhaps
a great deal of it is gang driven.
Yeah, so where there's been multi-generational gangs like Los Angeles and so forth, that's still bad. San Diego, it's not bad at all. Although Tijuana across the border is a very high murder rate. This is an important area that more study needs to be devoted to.
So it was hard to pick a spot to break up the conversation in half, and so I arbitrarily picked this point, even though we have more to say about some of the general racial questions in the rest of the conversation, but I decided arbitrarily to pick this one. And as I said at the introduction, next week we'll be back with part two, where we gradually shift gears into higher education, college admissions, and some productive, I think, constructive reform ideas. Now, to get out today, I couldn't decide whether to use Phil Oakes' famous tune, Love Me, I'm a Liberal, for its perfect takedown of liberal hypocrisy, but I decided to go instead with Pink Floyd's classic tune, Part 2 of Another Brick in the Wall, with those classic and very applicable lyrics. We don't need no thought control, no dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave those kids alone. Bye-bye, everybody. Ricochet. Join the conversation.